Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. The state of Florida is dotted with natural springs that have attracted visitors since long before they became 1950s roadside attractions. And while many preservationists who study Florida's springs focus on their ecology and the symbolism of a pure, pristine font, one author is connecting the social role that springs have played throughout history for a more realistic look at their evolution and possibly their future. Jason O'Donohue is an archaeologist at the Florida Bureau of Archaeological Research in Tallahassee, and he's the author of a new book called Water from Stone, Archaeology and Conservation at Florida's Springs. Jason O'Donohue, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking with a Florida archaeologist about Florida's natural springs and the vital role that they've played in the history of humanity on our peninsula. Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK to share your thoughts or any questions you have. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Jason, you begin your book with a trip to a popular attraction called The Glen, where dozens of boats filled with people head every weekend. Tell me a little bit about that place and how that visual of flocks of people at a spring informed this book.
Well, that place you're referring to is Silver Glen Springs. It's in northeast Florida along the St. Johns River on the eastern edge of the Ocala National Forest. It's a Forest Service recreation area, and as you said, it's very popular for visitors. It's got a nice, flat, well-maintained lawn. It's got concessions, and it's easily accessible from the river, just a short, about a half-mile jaunt from the St. Johns River itself, so people frequently will move from the river up the spring run and to the spring to enjoy a day or a weekend or longer of the splashing in the spring waters. And Silver Glen is also home, unbeknownst to many of those visitors, to some of the most significant archaeological sites in the state of Florida. And while I was a student at the University of Florida pursuing my PhD, I worked with Dr. Ken Sassman and his St. John's Archaeological Field School on many of those sites surrounding Silver Glen Springs itself. And it was striking to me and to others working there, not only how abundant the archaeological resources were, but how unaware so many people seemed to be about what a significant place this was in Florida's ancient past. And that in turn led me to exploring some of the greater spring conservation narratives, and it's something that I began to see over and over again, is that the incredible depth of human activity at springs and the variability of that activity at different places on the landscape was largely overlooked.
Do you feel like that kind of people kind of have this feeling that they've discovered for the first time this beautiful, pristine, clean, virgin spring, and that's kind of how we, you know, in popular culture, it just kind of comes across as this thing that's never been messed with. It's just never been seen. Do you think that causes people to maybe overlook some of the archaeological significance?
Sure. I certainly think that is part of it. I mean, it is clean, right? The water is crystal clear coming out. It's filtered through the limestone bedrock of Florida. So when you compare it to something like the St. Johns River itself or like swamps or wetlands that are more abundant in the state with their sort of dark, murky water with, you know, alligators and snakes lurking beneath, it does seem like this sort of pristine, idyllic landscape that you would like to visit, sure.
So people that visited the springs hundreds or thousands of years ago, was there anything that they may have done to alter the springs for future generations?
Absolutely. We can look, you know, and that's one of the common things that you see in conservation efforts is this idea of a pristine past that we can return to. You know, springs are they're important places for many Floridians today, but they're faced with a variety of threats as well. So springs, despite their clean appearance, many of them are becoming increasingly polluted by runoff from agricultural and residential fertilizers. As a result, some of the native vegetation that would be living in the spring water is being replaced by algal mats, both kind of coating the native vegetation and also floating on the surface of the spring and choking out some of the native flora and fauna that would live there.
So what kind of things could ancient peoples have done? What may have been done in the past that could have altered the springs as we came to view them in modern history?
Well, they do many of the same things that we do today. So you can see many springs would have at one time been surrounded by wetlands and Many now have been filled in. They've had retaining walls put around them or stairs installed for people to more easily access the waters. And in many ways, natives did similar kinds of things. It's not necessarily for the same purpose. So we often see through the activities that took place adjacent to the springs, we see a similar sort of thing. So wetlands that were once adjacent to the spring are covered over, and then this sort of elevates the landscape around the spring. So, you know, we look at Silver Glen, and that that nice manicured lawn that surrounds the spring head is actually built up on about 2 meters of archaeological site that was built up some 4,000 to 6,000 years ago. So we're quite literally, you know, engaging in our recreation activities on a foundation of ancient deposits.
So the water that is coming from the springs is coming from the Floridan aquifer?
That's right, in most cases.
And where does the water come from to fill that Floridan aquifer?
Well, it's ultimately derived from precipitation. So the Floridan aquifer is one of the most productive freshwater aquifers in the world. It's the source of the drinking water for greater than 90% of Florida's population, but it also extends up into Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, the surrounding states. And it's essentially comprised of limestone, and limestone can be very porous, particularly when rainwater falling down, filtering through sediments, and then finally hitting the limestone bedrock can begin to dissolve pores and caverns that then in turn can store that fresh water. And that fresh water that's stored within the limestone circulates from the areas where it's being recharged, where the precipitation is falling, usually at a higher elevation, and then flows to areas where it's discharged, to places like natural springs.
So has that water changed over time?
In terms of its abundance or in terms of
its quality?
Yeah, it certainly has. And again, that you know, we particularly can see that over since maybe 1950, when we start to have really good records about how much water is flowing out of springs and what the quality of that water is. Since 1950, there's been a 10x increase in the amount of pollutants in spring water. And again, that's primarily derived from agricultural application of fertilizers, and that has an abundance of negative effects for the flora and fauna that live within the spring.
So those pollutants that you're finding, are those coming directly from the Floridan aquifer, or are those things that have run off into the spring on the top?
They're coming from the aquifer, and that's one of the aspects of it that makes things so difficult is where the water enters the aquifer is often very far removed from where it exits the aquifer. So you could have people applying fertilizer, you know, 50 miles away from where the spring is, but that fertilizer will percolate down through the soil, get into the aquifer through the bedrock, and then be transported and discharged out the spring.
And then we often hear about the impact of climate change and rising sea levels and how that could erode Florida's shores and threaten important ecosystems. Do springs face any similar threats from climate change?
They do. In one sense, rising seas will increase the amount of flow from springs because the sea level is ultimately the water within the Floridan aquifer can float on top of that more dense saline water. So that'll ultimately start pushing more water out of the springs. But all the fresh water that's in the aquifer is not being replaced by more fresh water. It's being replaced by salt water. So particularly in coastal areas, you're starting to see greater salinity in the water that's flowing out of springs.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't even think of that, but that's an interesting aspect that I don't know that many people have considered.
True, and changing patterns in precipitation as well. You know, that can, for example, with the conversion of many, with the drainage and conversion of many inland wetlands into agricultural areas, that's reduced the coastal sea breezes that drive storms from the coast onto the shore. So in many ways, we're seeing less precipitation and thus less recharge to the aquifer, less water available to flow from the spring as a result of human changes to the landscape that are, again, far removed from where the springs are.
And then it may also be impactful if we have a ton of rain all at once and it runs off instead of being able to seep in.
Yes.
With the more extreme weather patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to the ancient peoples, what kinds of ancient beliefs or rituals did the springs come to represent for earlier cultures?
Well, we can't say, you know, with any degree of specificity what a particular spring or may have meant or what sort of rituals may have been conducted per se. But what we can say is that we know in many cases that springs were significant gathering places. So we can look archaeologically at the evidence of what people did, but we can't necessarily get at the beliefs that they had in their head. But again, we know that many springs, Silver Glen being an excellent example, were gathering places hundreds, thousands of years ago that drew people from across the Florida Peninsula from as far as 200 kilometers away. So these were significant sites where there's evidence of massive feasts going on, of mound building, perhaps of, in some cases of the burial of the dead, either in mounds or in other areas. So we can say in a general sense that there were activities taking place there that were beyond everyday, beyond the everyday activity. There were special things taking place. They were, you know, you're not going to get together with people from 200 kilometers away on a weekly basis, but you maybe will do it annually, maybe you do it a couple times a year.
So yeah, no, they didn't have cars back then. It wouldn't have been as easy to do that, for sure.
It would not have been as easy now.
In Chapter 4, you talked about sacredness and about how springs have a cross-cultural significance as somewhat sacred. Is that where the title comes from, Water from Stone? It kind of evokes that unlikeliness of water springing out of a rock.
It does, and you know, I think in many ways that has to do with how different, you know, as I spoke to earlier, how different springs are from other water bodies. You know, instead of water falling down as rain, it's coming up from the ground. You know, in Florida, instead of being relatively still and murky, it's clear and it's moving. It's constantly moving, constantly flowing out from beneath the ground. You know, it's so in those ways, those sort of physical properties of springs, those aesthetic properties of springs, yeah, do lend themselves to sort of a specialness or a sacredness, if you will, not just in Florida, but we see examples of that, you know, across the world of people venerating springs at special places.
Is it your hope maybe that this inherent sacredness might cause people to come together to help save the springs of Florida from overuse and other environmental damages?
Well, my hope is not that, you know, I don't think we can rely on the inherent sacredness of anything at this point.
Yeah, that's true.
My hope is actually that we can draw lessons from the past and understand, you know, whether every spring was considered sacred in Florida 5,000 years ago or not is unclear, but we can certainly see that some springs were marked out as being more special than others because they have this evidence of massive gatherings, because they have large mounds built next to them. So we can look at those individual cases and try to understand, okay, well, if these places were sacred or if these places were significant, why was that so? What were the circumstances that made those places special? And how can we then maybe apply that to springs more generally today and use that to increase public sentiment and help hopefully motivate political will towards their preservation?
A topic that we've covered on our show before is the idea of our planet entering a new epoch, a new period of geological time as defined by humanity's impact on the planet. Some people call it the Anthropocene. How do you see humanity's relationship with springs continuing to change in this time period?
Well, again, I'll return to that concept of a pristine spring that I talked briefly about before. You know, one of the lessons that archaeology can teach us is that this is an impossible goal to reach, to restore springs to a pristine state. And that's not because it will be difficult, but because it's an imaginary goal. There is no time. We can't go back to springs and find a time where they weren't in some ways impacted by humans or they weren't vastly different than they are today because the climate was so different. But in some ways, this is also, it may seem like that's a negative attitude, but it's also a cause for hope, because rather than looking backwards and trying to restore springs to some imagined pristine state, we can instead look to the future and try to engineer or imagine what we want springs to be like in the future and make that our goal, make that our target for conservation, rather than trying to stay still in time or to reverse time again to some imaginary past.
And it does sound like a hopeful prognosis, as long as we get everybody on board. As long as you get everyone on board. Well, I want to leave it there for now, but thank you so much for taking your time to talk with us. Archaeologist Jason O'Donohue, author of the new book, Water from Stone. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll talk with Florida's poet laureate and a composer from Southwest Florida about a unique evening of poetry and music coming to Naples later this month. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.